Good evening, you guys. At this time, we begin the technical event from New York City. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. I'm usually the net control, but not the only one. You'll also be hearing our KC2 WGB, John, WS2N, Paul, and Hal, K6DPZ. That group of four guys tries to organize this enthusiastic group that meets here. This group that has curiosity. And radio wise, we think this is where the elite meet, but we're not sure about that. Let me drop. Many smart people have come to the conclusion that mankind makes the majority of progress when it displays curiosity. And the curiosity can be about anything. It doesn't have to be scheduled, programmed, organized, if you know what I mean. Just a curiosity about anything. And one of the things that's easy to become curious about is wireless products. How in the world does that radio signal come out of that simple wire piece of antenna, go 10, 20,000 miles into space, around the Earth, and talk to somebody else? How does it do that, that radio wave? What does it really look like? How do those antennas and transmission lines and receivers and transmitters and satellites, how does all that jazz work? From my point of view, the schools do a less than mediocre job of teaching wireless technology. You really want somebody who understands radio, you got to hire a ham radio operator, a guy who's got enthusiasm in that area. He's done tinkering. He's been fiddling around with transmitters, receivers, and antennas. You notice that the first thing that a ham radio operator does when he talks to another ham radio operator after they've passed back and forth the handle and QTH, the very next piece of information almost always is, what kind of a transmitter are you using? What kind of a transmitter, what kind of receiver you're using, what kind of a transmission line, what kind of an antenna, how high up is it? Is that your first antenna or is that your fourth antenna? How well is it working compared to the other ones you've tried? I mean, one of the main things we do is pass information back and forth as to what works and what doesn't work. And step by step, we know a little bit more about this mystery of wireless equipment. So the people who gather here, you'll notice that they ask questions on very similar subjects. How do I make my stuff work better? How do I understand the way it works? What is this stuff called packet? What is this stuff called digital radio? What is this K1 Joe Taylor, K1JT? What are those kind of information? That protocol, how in the world does it have the ability to listen to a signal that's 28 decibels weaker than the noise and it still gets a coherent message out of it? How in the world does that thing do that? How do cell phones really work? How does a radio frequency identification interrogator, how does it work? What's inside of a radio RF, radio frequency identification tag? What's in that tag that allows it to transmit 96 bits of information? And that little thing can do so at 20, 25 feet with a real good reader. And it's reprogrammable. And right now they run something like 25 cents. The day will come when those things are going to be a nickel apiece. They're going to be everywhere. So if you think you've heard the end of the story on radio, not at all. It's a developing project. It's a process in motion. It's a progress in, what is it? It's a project in motion, project in transition. A person signs into the technical net during the first hour because he's got a question or a comment that he wants to give us. He's going to give us his call letters, his name, and the word yes. That means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in might sound something like this, a KC2NJI, Mike and yes.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, I'm glad to see I haven't timed out the Eastern machine. It's still working. So you need not sign in because you're listening. After 32 years, this is TechNet number 1,528 of the series that began in September of 1982, 32 years ago. So we think it's a near record of one group of people in command of you know, the net control for 32 solid years. So we think it's a bit of a record. We don't know. But as I'm saying, after 32 years, we don't need a long list of people signing in saying that they're listening. Right now, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed anymore. So give me a call that is a name right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WH1RY, Joe?
Yes.
Okay, we got that mystery guy, Joe. He's a frequent sign-in. Glad to hear from you tonight, Joe. Who else would like to check in? Because they do have a question or comment. Give me your call letters and name right now.
This is N2KW. Alan, yes.
Haven't heard you for a long time, Alan. Glad you're good you're back with us. Okay, we've got Joe and Alan. Who else would like to check in? Because they do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now.
US2N. Paul with this week's space report. Good evening, Dick, John, Al.
Very fine, Paul. And I think it was last week, either you or John checked in, not only the ordinary check-in, because you really had a question, I forgot you. Yeah, Paul gives us the space report as to what National Aeronautics and Space Administration, John, KC2WGB, monitors the internet to make sure that we're not missing people by way of IRLP or Echo Link. And he also handles the mailbag for the guys who don't have a valid ham license yet or don't have the right equipment so they can sign in and talk to us live. This is the main thing that the TechNet is a live, on the air, real-time exchange of ideas and information. We are not promising that you're ever going to get a written consulting service free of charge by way of the TechNet. That was not what was volunteered. What's volunteered is on-the-air information. Alrighty, we've got Joe and Alan. Anyone else would like to check in because they do have a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me a call letters and name right now.
Hey, says Delta Papa Zulu with the quickie answers.
Yeah, I should have mentioned him. I mentioned him earlier, but in this relisting, I didn't mention Hal. And if you go to Hal's website, you'll see a huge amount of electronics that he has worked with for the last 30 years. So he has touched lots and lots of pieces of equipment. And I know that Wes is also signing it. Who else do we have with a question or a comment? Give me a call with his name right now. Okay. Maybe we'll pick up some more people later on. Joe, W2RYY, sometimes you've asked some pretty deep questions that really kept us going in the past. Are you going to give us one of those tonight? Go easy with us tonight, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Would I let you down? Of course not. Here's a good question for you, W2RYY. What all these talking here of these more intelligent cars coming out that'll be able to drive themselves and have collision avoidance systems and so forth and so on, a lot of this stuff operates on radar frequencies. In fact, it operates on very, very high frequency radar frequencies, in the range of, I believe you said once, something like 94 gig or something like that. As more and more and more of these cars come about, especially the ones that have collision avoidance systems, if they do indeed operate on radar, maybe I'm wrong. What starts happening when you start putting a bunch of these cars together on a highway, like your cars going the same way, cars going, you know, coming a different way, all operating within the same or similar band close to each other? Does that cause any kind of conflict as far as you think you'd perceive going down the road there? K2RW, W2RYY. You think that's a good one?
Yeah, without a doubt, Joe, that's a good one. Using good old common sense, you would assume a whole lot of automobile radars, and by the way, roughly 78 gigahertz has been set aside for automobile wireless electronics that does collision avoidance and car-to-car spacing sensing when you go around a corner, sensing whether or not there's an obstacle there. 78 gigs has been set aside. 94 gigs has been, to some degree, set aside for doing TSA investigations. Transportation Security Authority, when they're using either passive or active electronics that tries to scan your clothing to find out whether or not you've got weapons hidden under that clothing. Quite a few of those systems work at 94 gigahertz. So 78 gigs for automobiles. And the 78 gig band has got a couple of advantages. It's high enough in frequency. Let me drop it. It's high enough in frequency that very small antennas can give you high directivity, sort of like a flashlight beam. And you know what that parabolic reflector looks like on a flashlight, and you know what the beam coming out of that flashlight looks like. So a 78 gigs is an ideal frequency for doing that kind of communicating radio-wise. You also know that the global positioning satellite system, working on 1578 megs, if I remember correctly. I think it's something like that, 1578. I've forgotten the frequency. However, every single American global positioning satellite is on the exact same frequency. And I think at any one period of time, 24 of them are active. And if you're in a good location, you might be able to see almost 12 of those satellites simultaneously. And they're all on the exact same frequency to the nearest fraction of a hertz of frequency offset. You might say, how in the world does the receiver figure out what's going on? And it's done by the fact that each one of the individual satellites has its own individual gold code. It's a spread spectrum type of communication by which each satellite transmits a specific pseudo-random code, and the pseudo-random code flips back and forth between being a right-side-up or an upside-down code. In other words, if it's supposed to be 1100 right now, that would be the right-side-up code. And if on the if it's transmitting a 1, it would be 1100, just the first four digits of something like 1,000 digits, 1,000 ciphers. And then if it's going to transmit a 1 instead of a 0 or a 0 instead of a 1, it does the exact same thing opposite, 1100 instead of 0011. So by transmitting a specific code, the receiver is able to easily select one satellite versus another. Let me drop it. And that property of looking for a specific code in the radio world is called orthogonality. You can easily have 28 orthogonal codes, and even a greater number of gold codes, as they're called, where the number of ones and number of zeros in the whole sequence of the pseudo-random code is essentially equal, exactly 50% ones and 50% zeros, but they're arranged differently. And as such, the satellite can easily... The receiver can easily select satellite number 14 versus satellite number 24 because of the uniqueness of the code. And when you're listening to code on satellite number 24, and you might want to know how much interference you're getting from satellite number 14 on the exact same frequency. And you could say that that interference is 30 decibels weaker. It's not even there as far as the receiver is concerned. So by way of gold codes, you can have a very large number of transmitters on the exact same frequency, and they don't interfere with each other. Not too different from what flying bats do. Let me drop. That animal bark out, their eyes are giving them very little information. They're figuring out the situation awareness is coming from the sonar that they're transmitting, the chirping that they're doing, ultrasonic usually, and each individual bat has his own way of chirping. He recognizes his echoes compared to the 5,000 or 4,999 other echoes. You could call that a kind of a gold code that Mother Nature did millions of years ago when Mother Nature invented the bat, so to speak. A beautiful evolutionary system. So by way of gold codes, you can have lots and lots of things on the exact same frequency and not interfering with each other by spread spectrum techniques, among other techniques. So that's probably not a problem, Joe. Now, to make a car, let me drop. To make a car have enough artificial intelligence so it can easily recognize a human being in front of it and not run it over or run around the corner as it's about to make a turn, it better be pretty darn sophisticated. However, even if the automatically driven cars occasionally make an error, you might ask yourself, is that tolerable? By way of the errors that human beings make, in the United States, you have close to 40,000 Americans per year that die on our highways. A high percentage of those deaths are due to a human being making an error of some kind. And if the automatic machinery makes an error rate that's 10 times better than that, it sounds terrible, but it might be an improvement. So, it looks like that's going to be the future. Automation is certainly here to stay. There's lots of places where automation has caught on very well, and we can't go back as I see it. That genie is out of the bottle. That's a bunch of opinions. Drag your feet, Joe, in case there are other people who know more about this subject and are going to give us the benefit of their wisdom. So drag your feet. Anyone else wants to tell us about automatic driven cars, sort of what Google has been experimenting with among other factories, give me a call that is right now, And if not, Joe's going to pick up to V2RYY with a delay. K2RYW in the TechNet.
I guess not. Yeah, I guess what I was thinking of, or trying to think of, it was the device on the car sending out a signal and looking for an echo from something, you know, at a distance away. The collision avoidance could be a car ahead of you at so many feet away or whatever. And what I was thinking of, even though it's, you know, using that kind of technology, spread spectrum, if it perhaps would have some sort of, you know, problem where something else is coming the same way, running, you know, power in the same band aimed at it from another direction, when that would basically cancel out the echo it's looking for and confuse the thing, or mask the echo to begin with, even though it's running spread spectrum technology. I understand it's looking, looking at a bit of the code, but does this run into a problem where, you know, I put so much information within it, so much of a bandwidth at one time, and have so many transmitters running, even though running spread spectrum technology? Back to you.
A partial answer to what you're asking, Joe, was demonstrated to me and my son, Chris. KB2IQN. We were both at a radio control model airplane meet that takes place in September every year, and we went there for the fifth or sixth year, a month and a half ago. It's called the NEAT Fair, NEAT, Northeast Aero Technology. This is a group of people who fly battery-operated radio control model airplanes. And near the end of the event on each one of the days, they hold a massive war event where something like 40 aircraft get launched simultaneously. They're all on the exact same 2.4 or 2.3 gigahertz band, all using spread spectrum. And these 40 aircraft, each individual transmitter, the 40 pilots on the ground and the 40 aircraft in the air, have no electronic problems because of the spread spectrum technique. It works that well. Let me drop. So if you set up the right kind of a gold code with spread spectrum techniques, you can easily have more than 30 decibels of separation between equal amplitude signals that are on the exact same frequency. The first place where you finally run into a problem, and by the way, whether you're transmitting one way or looking for an echo, the gold code, the spread spectrum system, works equally well. I mean, whether the signal has gone two ways, out reflecting off something and came back, or one way from the transmitter to receiver, the RF link is relatively similar in both of those cases. The one case where you will run into a problem with spread spectrum techniques is called the near-far problem. The spread spectrum technique where the gold code allows you to select satellite number 24 and reject satellite number 14 that were both in view at this instant time. The method by which you do that requires a certain degree of linearity of the electronics. So therefore, if satellite number 24, the one you want to listen to, is 10,000 miles above you, which is the altitude of global positioning satellites, and if somebody decides to test a satellite and place it 10 feet from you, so you've got one satellite 10,000 miles away, and you've got one satellite 10 feet away, and they're both transmitting the same amount of power on the exact same frequency with their individual gold codes, spread spectrum codes. Let me drop. That example I just gave is an extreme case of what's called the near-far problem. That's the one place where this gold code spread spectrum really breaks down. That satellite that's 10 feet from you is giving you a signal that is so potent, that signal might be 140 decibels above threshold of your receiver. It is overloading the living daylights out of your front end. It's making third order, fifth order, seventh order intermodulation distortion products. It's desensitizing your system right at the front end, right at the antenna connector, so to speak. In that particular case, yes. Are you going to hear that satellite at 10,000 miles? No way in hell. So you give me, on that frequency, a strong enough local signal that really violates the so-called near-far criteria, the system will crash. Well, you'll hear the near one, but you won't hear the far one. But until you get an amplitude so strong that you create nonlinearity in the receiver, up until that point, and by the way, by using step attenuators, you might be able to recover that situation. But up until that point, spread spectrum works like a charm. How did the bats avoid the near-far problem? some of those echoes the bat is looking for is the wall of the cave that's, 500 feet away. Let me drop. And he has another bat that's flying right alongside of him, 2 feet away. And he's able to do that. Mother Nature's able to do that. And there's another thing that can be done along these lines, and that is once you've aligned to the echoes of your particular code, you can create time domain holes in the receiver. In other words, you do what's called the alligator fix. You know what an alligator does? He closes his jaws just at the instant that the piece of food that was thrown at him is just going right past his jaw. He closes his jaws at just the right time. You can set up a receiver that once you know that you're getting echoes from your particular code at a particular distance, and you know when to receive the echoes, and you open up a window at that instant of time and close the window during all other periods of time, except for the periods of time where the near-far undesired satellite is transmitting pulses that walk through your windows, except for that little bit of a interference, even the near-far problem, there's multiple solutions, and I've just given you one of them. So I see a lot of future for this system, Joe. When the amateur radio operators, let me drop. Way back in the mid-50s, when the amateur radio operators started experimenting with single sideband, which by the standards of the day, was a very complicated transmitting technique, and various amateurs said, why should I have to do this? You had to build almost everything in those days, very little of it could you buy, and why should I go through all of this jazz of building a product detector for the receiver and a single sideband transmitter, an exciter for the transmitter. Why should they go through all of that? And the answer is single sideband has got a tremendous improvement in receiver threshold, long-range communication, anti-jamming technique, squeezing a whole lot of signals into the same bandwidth. It's worth the effort. And some of these more elaborate protocols for modulation techniques, digital analog and combined modulation techniques today. You take, for instance, the 8VSB method of transmitting digital television today, where you can put 6 or 8 pieces of information, video and audio, on the exact same 6 megacycle bandwidth. We drop. In theory, that gives you a hell of an advantage. Every one of your 6 meg channels that used to be good for one piece of information, one program, can now handle, let me pick a number, 6 individual programs simultaneously. That's the good news. The bad news is it's got some vulnerability, though it doesn't have as much range, and it can't tolerate impulse noise. So we paid our money, we made the choice, and here we are. The whole nine United States has switched over to digital television. We've made the commitment. We're going to learn to live with it. Over to you, Joe. To D2RYY, great question. D2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, I think you pretty much answered it, I guess. I was pretty much thinking about the same thing, like you said, you listen to a satellite or some signal that's, X number of miles away, then an extremely weak signal, and if you had something very, within the same band, much, much closer. That's what I was talking about, pretty much, like if you had, if the radar, these cars is all operate within the same band, you got something emitting, looking at you, putting it, call the forward wave at you, while you're trying to listen to a reflected wave from a target that's in front of you, that's what it's kind of getting at. Even though it's, running, you're running a code, he's running a code, can you get to a point where the receiver says, I can't handle this, it's digital information, something else is crashing me, and I don't know what to do with it. At least one thing I hope this one up to do is to take that receiver or receiving information and put it into the car's computer or store the information in case that does happen. So if some event happens, like an accident, traffic occurrence happens, they could go back and say, well, at this particular time, the receiver did experience this type of phenomenon. So they have something to say, well, it was an external source that affected the receiver, possibly. It's just to have that as a recordability type of event. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there is a computer chip in most of our cars nowadays that gives a continuous recording of how fast the car was moving, at what time. In some cases, it's tied to a GPS system, so you know where the car was located, what direction it was aimed, were the brakes being applied, was the gas pedal being applied. All kinds of information is, in theory, recoverable from that computer system. that maybe is or isn't part of the emission control system in automobiles. The number of lines of code that are in our automobiles is doubling every year or so. Millions and millions of lines of code. And keeping track of all that in our automobiles is going to be really something else. Occasionally gives you trouble, as we know from the Toyota situation, where there no longer is a direct mechanical linkage between the gas pedal and the carburetor. It's now a shaft encoder on the gas pedal, and that in turn goes into a computer, and the computer says, I think he's demanding more thrust right now. I think he has pressed down on the accelerator pedal, and it makes a bunch of changes to the automobile. Let me drop it. So a series of microprocessors, software, and whatever adjusts the transmission system, the carburation system, the fuel mixture, the air-fuel mixture, the timing, all kinds of things get changed in order to give you that 35 miles per gallon, so to speak, with very low undesired emissions. And so it's got a lot of advantages. But if something goes haywire with that system, where it thinks, because of an error, that you've demanded full blast acceleration, and you haven't, and if you're already up to, let me pick a number, 50 miles an hour, and if that engine goes flat out, as it has on a number of occasions, and then you use all the braking you've got, in some cases you're wasting your time. You're way beyond the point where the brakes will become glazed. You can burn up the brakes all the way down to the metal, and the car is not going to stop. In other words, beyond a certain velocity, many of our automobiles have more go than whoa. And when that happens, my goodness, can you get into an awful lot of trouble. You have to program into your mind that if your car goes into a runaway condition, you're going to first try to put on the brakes. You're going to try to do the normal things. If that doesn't work, your very next response is you will shift it into neutral. Don't worry about whether or not the engine will be damaged. You're trying to save your life. When the car's in a runaway condition, you will shift it into neutral. And if that doesn't work, you'll turn off the key. You'll turn off the key very gently, not to the point where the steering is locked. But you have to program your mind ahead of time to do these things if you get a runaway condition, because under the heat of battle, of a car running away where you're panicking, and you don't think of these things, and you're trying to ride the brakes, and you're trying to steer the car away from the obstacles that are in front of you, other cars that are on the highway, under those conditions, without prior programming, you might not do the right thing, and you might not survive. So there were quite a number of vehicles starting way back in, I think it was 1997 or so, which started having
repeater, timeout.
And the point of all this is that all the microprocessors that we have in our cars are giving us great advantages. But whenever you've got a fly-by-wire system, whether it be an airplane or an automobile, there are some definite disadvantages. There are times when that system can fight you and do an awful lot of disadvantages. Yeah, go ahead. Somebody said comment. I heard you on the input. I'm not hearing through the machine. I hope you got your PL turned on. K2RIW.
Roger, Dick. This is Kilo 1, Mike Juliet, Mike. Dick, besides the accelerator, some of the higher-end Nissans also have no connection between the brakes and the person driving and the steering and the person driving. Everything is fly-by-wire. Back over to you. Got my little comment there. K1, MJM, clear.
Sandy, what a comment. Yeah, good. John recognized. Fantastic. That was Mike number 2. Mike number 1 is K1 NJI, I think it is, yes. And Mike number 2 is K1 MJM. K2 NJI. Wait a minute now. I'm terrible. I don't remember things like this. KC2 NJI is Mike number 1, where he has the website amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there and all of the tech nets for the last 8 or so years are recorded, and you can play them back. Mike number 2 has this beautiful website that's called limarktechnet.com. And you go there and you see a lot of additional information with reference to the TechNet. So that's brand new information to me, Mike. Wow. The brakes and the steering are now getting into fly-by-wire. Oh, that makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. Of all the things that I don't want to lose in an automobile, I don't want to lose control of the gas pedal. I certainly don't want to lose control of the brakes. And my goodness, I don't want to lose control of the steering wheel. And when you make those things fly by wire, when they're not pure mechanical, there are times when Murphy's Law is going to get you. And you may know that there's a corollary to Murphy's Law, and that is there's something called Elmer's Law. little bit of a joke, but it gets the point across. Elmer's Law states that Murphy was an optimist. The real world's a little worse. So if something can possibly go wrong, it can. And let me pass it back to you for a quick one on this one, Mike. Rick, do you know of any backup system? In other words, in the case of brake failing, in theory, you still have an emergency brake, which in the past has been a pure mechanical connection between that handle or that pedal and the braking system. In the case of steering, if the electronic steering fails and there is no mechanical backup, that doesn't sound good. And if the brakes...
Repeater, timeout.
And if the brakes fail, is there a backup? To your knowledge, how late... are we talking about 2015 automobiles, or did it start in 2013, Mike? This is a new one on me. And is there any fallback and backup systems that you know about? K1MJM, the guy who's giving us this exciting piece of information. K2IZW in the TechNet.
I believe these were 2013 vehicles that came out in later 2000, end of 2012.
Okay, that's the year that they started doing this. What brand name do you think has been doing it, Mike? And also, do you believe there's any kind of a backup if the electronic system fails? If I turn that steering wheel, and if all of a sudden it's no longer moving those wheels in front of the automobile, it's not changing their angle of attack, if you know what I mean, I'm going to get awful unhappy real fast. K1MJM, K2IZW.
Dick, it's only the high-end Nissan. That's the only vehicle that's doing it as far as I know so far, but I'm sure it's at least the high-end Nissan, and there is no backup. You know, if the wire falls off, oh well.
Okay. Now, when it comes to a runaway gas pedal, with proper pre-programming, where you study the situation mentally, and you tell yourself, if I get this condition, this is what my response is going to be. You can plan ahead of time, and in many cases, save your life. In the case of losing steering or losing brakes, wow. I guess losing brakes, I might be able to downshift the automobile and get some braking action, at least get it down to a lower velocity. In the case of losing steering, I think the only protection you've got is to slam on the brakes, a panic stop right away, and hope you're not in the middle of a three-lane highway where everyone else is now going to crash into you. That's a tough one. Maybe John's got a solution to this one. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone. You know what I find very strange, Dick? In the 50s, in the early 50s, when they started with cruise control, up until now, when you touched the brake, it automatically disconnected the cruise control, whether it was vacuum-driven or however they did it. It's amazing they didn't write that into the computer. No matter what you're doing, when you hit the brake, if you hold the brake for 2 seconds, the engine should go to at least idle in the programming. You know, something like that. I just find that incredible that they didn't do that.
There's a very good reason they didn't do that, John. As I've heard the story, I may have some of the details wrong. The first car that had fly-by-wire with runaway automobiles was Audi, and I think that was somewhere in the early 1990s. And Audi, for quite a few of those runaway automobiles, was saying that it was pilot error, that somebody had pressed on the brake, pressed on the accelerator when they think they're pressing on the brake. And that's a very difficult scenario to confirm, because all of us know that the brake pedal and the accelerator pedal are at two very different altitudes, very different positions, and have a very different feel. You press on the accelerator pedal, it'll easily go to the floor. You press on the brake pedal, it'll resist you. It's got a very different feel. So for somebody to make that mistake and be blamed on pilot error for a runaway automobile, the customers that were getting blamed for that protested immediately. The Audi owners were high-end human beings, you know what I mean? These were affluent people, highly educated people who could afford a very expensive automobile, and they said, no way, Jose, you're blaming us for the wrong thing. And Audi finally figured out what's going on. It was runaway. They wrote a computer program that when you touched the brake pedal, it forced the engine to be in idle speed no matter where the engine thought the gas pedal was located. So Audi wrote that program and patented it. To my understanding, Toyota did not want to pay the royalty on that patent until they found some other way around it. That wasn't existing in the Toyota programming of their emission control computer. You see what's going on there, John? KC2WGB, it's dollars. K2LAW in the tech man.
Well, that's very difficult to believe that you could patent something that's a life-saving item and another company can't use it without paying for it. And there's no other way to write that around. I guess that's the way it happened. But the other thing you're talking about now, when you talk about shifting into neutral, or if you lose your brakes, you think you can gear down. Well, you can gear down when the motor is running. The problem is the new transmissions, the automatic transmissions, don't have rear pumps. And that's why you can't push start them, because you will not get a connection between your drivetrain and your engine, because there's no rear pump. Some, you know, they saved a few bucks. So I didn't know if you were familiar with that, but that may not work.
Yeah, I've heard of that one before, John. Let me ask you this question. Quite a few people, when going down a long, dry hill, want to save their brakes, then they will downshift. And from what you're telling me, as long as the engine is running, I can do the downshifting. And once I get it into the lower gear, apparently it will stay there. But now I'm worried. If I'm running down a long hill, and I happen to be low on gasoline, I'm running down a long hill, I've downshifted to the first gear, and the engine runs out of gasoline and stops running. Does that mean I'm no longer in first gear? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
I don't believe so, Dick, because the motor was turning, which was rotating the torque converter. The front pump was running. As long as that's running and turning, it's going to maintain pressure on the clutch plates. So I think you would maintain a reduction. But if you were to stop the motion of that pump by the engine going to zero, then you would be in trouble. That's what I believe.
Yeah, I see that. While we're on the subject of automobiles, one of the things that every time I take one of these driver safety courses, defensive driving courses, which if you take them every 3 years or so, you get a discount on your automobile insurance. So my wife and I always take these courses. And when I bring to their attention a piece of information that's very well known in rural areas and very well unknown in metro areas, and I bring that to the attention of the instructors, instructors all act like they're hearing it for the first time. They've never heard it before. And that's this. If you're going down a long, dry hill, it's very advisable to put your automobile into a lower gear. It saves your brakes. You don't overheat the brakes. You're using engine as dynamic braking, and it works very well. Truck drivers do that, and they've got an even further version of that called Jake brakes, Jacobson brakes, where it changes the timing of the opening and closing of the valves of the engine, so that the engine gives you significant braking action when you downshift to go down a long hill with a heavy load. You do that on a dry hill. However, if you're about to go down a long hill that is icy, do you do that? Absolutely not. You ask the average person, what is the right thing to do when you're about to go down a long, icy hill? Do you put the car in drive? Do you put it in low gear? Or do you put it in neutral? It ain't common sense at first. The answer is you must put it in neutral. The people in rural areas where they have icy roads, where they don't use as much ice and sand as we do, they know that. Because when the car is in neutral going down a hill, you have the ability to pump the brakes. And each time you're letting up on the brakes, let me drop. Even if the wheels were beginning to slide because you're overbraking, every time you let up on the brakes because you're pumping or because you've got the anti-lock braking system, you now have a chance for the wheel to start turning at the rate that the road is going by, because if the wheel is not turning at road speed, there is no steering. That's a hard one to believe. If you're steering the front wheels, for instance, and they're doing a little bit of sliding, the wheel is turning 1 RPM slower than the road is going by, so it's doing a little bit of sliding, there is no steering traction. You have no steering under those conditions. So when the car is in neutral, each time you let up on the brake, The wheel has a minimum moment of inertia. It's not pushing a very massive engine. The wheel can immediately speed up, and you'll have steering. Whereas if you're engaged to an engine, the moment of inertia of the engine will not allow the wheel to speed up fast enough. The wheel will continue to slide. You have no steering. You end up either doing a spin or ending up off the side of the road in the gully, if you know what I mean. So long, icy roads, if you have no choice but to go down there, you're going to do it in neutral. And it doesn't matter whether you've got stick shift or automatic shift, you're going to do it in neutral. Very well unknown in metro areas. And now when you see some of the details of why, maybe it makes some sense. Okay, we've gone pretty far left of center, but we're going to go over to Alan now. He's going to get us back onto real electronics. November 2, Kilo Whiskey. Go right ahead, Alan. K2RIW on the TechNet. And what do those guys in New York City think we should be talking about tonight? We'll go to Eric right after Alan. Go ahead, Alan. Now, maybe Alan got called away for a minute, so Eric, you've got your window. Go right ahead. KE2EJ, the man who maintains all this electronics for us, K2RIW and the TechNet. K2RIW, K2EJ. I just want to
throw a little question to the guys Mike made about Nissan. I'll give you an example. On the Nissan, there's a mechanical backup system to prevent steering failure that kicks in via a clutch. There's a direct adaptive steering with a tail. Actually, in my car, I have the electric power, electrically controlled, electronically controlled power steering, but it's still mechanical. And as far as the braking go, we're not talking about trucks. Like in my car, I have generous braking, but the tire brake system really is still, the calipers are still run hydraulically. In trucks, they have electronically controlled calipers with motors. But they also have a backup system that uses the air that they use for their trailers and stuff like that. And in the Nissan and in a few others, it's basically a master cylinder, a traditional braking system with an electric motor and accumulator, which creates the power steering as opposed to the power braking as opposed to
K2RWK2J. I have another person on the input. I'll be picking you up in a second. But you've just brought up a very other interesting point, Eric. And that is we all have to program another thing into our brain. That if you're doing anything in your automobile where you think you're going to need braking, and if your engine has just stopped running for whatever reason, and you can't get it restarted, the engine running creates the vacuum. The vacuum creates all of the power assist to run your power braking. And if you now go down to the manual override on braking, unless you're a very strong person like Arnold Schwarzenegger and you can really stand on that brake pedal, other than that, you've got very partial braking without the engine vacuum. There is a vacuum cylinder that maintains some vacuum as a storage tank, so to speak. However, don't depend on it more than once. If your engine fails and you think you need braking, then you push down on that brake and do not let up until your car has come to a stop. Because maybe once, maybe twice, you can operate the brakes before you exhaust that vacuum storage tank. But if you're doing a whole lot of panic braking on and off with an engine not running, very rapidly you use up that vacuum reserve. You're down to manual braking. And on a modern-day automobile, manual braking without the vacuum assist is a very poor amount of braking. I wonder if that's also part of what we're addressing here, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, the point was really with the auto manufacturers, in terms of, control by wire, still rely on having a backup system. The statement that the other gentleman made that there's no backup system didn't jive with me, so I decided to look at that. And so it seems that the auto manufacturers and the National Transportation Safety Board requires backup systems. And even your conventional braking system is usually a two-part system, one which is power-assisted with power brakes, still has a mechanical brake, whereas, yes, it takes a heck of a lot more force on the pedal, but I wouldn't call it a partial braking system. I've had the braking system fail and stop the car. You don't need to be all wet. It's just not not touch it with the feather touch, it'll stop. So we have to stand on it. But even in my hybrid, actually, I changed the brake on it. So to do it with a braking system, you have to disconnect the battery because the accumulator pump can come on at any time. It'll start squirting hydraulic fluid out of your face. You don't want your fingers in the wrong place when it starts to twist the calipers. So, you know, don't think that there's, you know, your SOL when something bad happens. There is, in terms of safety systems, there is a backup. So, that was the point.
I hope you're right, but if I could interpret what I think Mike was telling us, the possibility exists, Eric, that the braking pedal really is now an electronic shaft encoder, which does not make direct mechanical connection.
Negative.
Okay, so you're saying it's not a shaft encoder. So you're positive there is a manual override to unassisted braking if that shaft encoder fails, is what I think you're saying, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you understand the way they make matches on, there's a direct connection between the pedal, which also has an imposition encoder on it, what I'm calling the shaft encoder. Mm-hmm. But there's still a mechanical linkage to the master cylinder, so we still get the mechanical pumping force. As opposed to the steering by wire, it's really the shaft and everything is there, and there's a clutch between the pinion gear and the shaft itself, where it's normally disconnected, and the servo is running the steering. But should the servo spill, then the clutch becomes de-energized, the clutch goes into the mechanical steering. And the trucks have something called EBS, electronic braking system, have actual motors in the calipers that squeeze onto the rotor. But they also have a hydraulic system that's brake fluid. So they have a backup system too. So. And if you think of an aircraft fly-by-wire, they usually three backup security systems. K2RWK, do the check.
Okay, that makes me feel a little bit more comfortable. There was another person that was checking in with some further information. Who was that? Please give us your call letters and your name. K2RIW in the TechNet. I'm fairly sure I heard another person. One of the people who signed in, and we've kept him waiting longer than we should have, was Alan. November 2 Kilo Whiskey. Or is it Whiskey 2 Kilo Whiskey? I think it's November 2 Kilo Whiskey. Yes. Alan, if you're there, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet. Looks like Alan got called away. Is there anyone else that we've missed who has a question for the early session, the first early section, the first hour of the TechNet, where we take simple questions and answers? Anyone else with a question? We seem to have an empty period right now. Give us your call letters and name. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, there being none, we'll move up our schedule. We're a little ahead of schedule with the mailbag tonight. If Alan does come back, November 2 Kilo Whiskey, we'll jump over to him as soon as he's back from whatever called him away. KC2WGB, are those guys that give you those mail-in questions that sometimes stump the daylights out of us? We're going to get another one of those tonight, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, one of them might be, Dick. But first, I think we should allow a reset and give a couple of extra seconds to see if anyone on Echolink wants to come in, because we've been a little short.
Okay, we're going to let the machine thoroughly drop. You've been monitoring the Echolink website, and have you seen anything that we should know about, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
No, Dick, there were about eight in before. It's dropped by two, and I just thought maybe one of them would want to ask a question, but apparently not. Okay, I'll let it drop on one of my first questions.
By the way, I did hear a man checking out Echolink earlier, a man who I think was in Guadalajara. It sounded like his call letters were X-ray Golf number 1, and I don't remember what the letters that succeeded that. So of those that you saw on EchoLink tonight, I wonder if, out of curiosity, if there was an X-ray Golf 1 in there. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
KC2WGV, yes, there was. That's Roberto in the state of Jalisco in Mexico. Yes, he's been a regular at times. He's on there right now, but no questions.
What is the suffix his call letters? X-ray Golf number one, and what's after that?
XE1GXG.
So it's X-ray Echo 1. No wonder I couldn't find him. I thought it was X-ray Golf. X-ray 1, Golf, X-ray Golf, if I understand you correctly. Very well. Go right ahead, John. By the way, it sounds like you've talked to Roberto before.
Yes, he has posted a few questions, and comes from my other home state in Mexico, so good guy. Probably busy down there.
Sounds good, John. Go right ahead with your next question. With your first.
ABC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I have one young amateur here who has heard of a Bessel null measurement. He'd like to know what it is, how it's done, and what is it used for. I'm sure you're familiar with it.
I use it all the time. I knew he would. I'll bet you when it comes to the proper setting of FM deviation, back in your days of analog television, where the audio was 25 kc approximately of deviation, 4.5 megahertz higher than the video carrier, I bet you used it a lot there. However, nowadays with digital television, do you still use Bessel knowing? Let's have a few words on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
Nope, that's the thing of the past. Jack's been using it on me. FM radio, see. That's kind of a gray area because they use these loudness processes that basically you stick anything in and it comes out blasting. But yeah, if you want to explain the Bessel function and deviation and the fact that it will null a part of the carrier when you have precisely that amount of deviation based upon the input level and the frequency that you're doing, going for whatever the value of deviation you're looking for, it's a real neat way of not having to have a deviation meter.
Yeah, I bet Hal has used this a lot. And don't overmodulate, you're a little heavy there, Hal. I mean, Hal. It is Hal. I'm terrible tonight. Go a little lighter on your mic, and with all the instrumentation that you've been setting up with your service monitors, I'm quite sure you've used Bessel knowing in order to get a precise amount of FM deviation. Let's hear a little bit about how you've done it, Hal. K6 Delta Papa Zulu, K2RIW in the TechNest.
IW TechNest, K6 DPC. Our weakness for calibrating deviation meters and also station monitors. It's a very accurate method for, you know, calibrating deviation. I can't see in, but that's where our applications are mainly used. Go ahead, Jack. Pick it up. K6DPC.
Very fine, Hal. I think your audio right now is set kind of high. I very, very strongly hear your breathing in between words. So I think the deviation is set. I think the audio gain in that particular rig you're using right now is set higher than you'd like it to be. FM modulation, so-called angular modulation, in the beginning, in the late 1930s, was very poorly understood. Various people predicted that it couldn't possibly work. I mean, when you have a crystal oscillator transmitting a signal, I'm just going to make a crazy set of numbers. Assume I've got a crystal oscillator multiplier assembly in a transmitter, and it's putting out 100 megacycle signal. And I turn on that transmitter, and I look at my spectrum analyzer, I tune my receiver to 100 megacycles, and I hear this beautiful signal. And as you tune the receiver across the band, you're hearing normal background noise, you hit that 100 megacycle signal, and all of a sudden your receiver turns quiet. The automatic gain control goes into operation, the receiver goes to a lower gain, the receiver turns quiet, and you're now hearing that carrier. That is the beginning of the radio process. The good news is now you hear that signal. And if somebody turns that signal on and off with a Morse code key, he's amplitude modulating it in a quasi-digital manner. And you've got the right kind of electronics in the circuit called a beat frequency oscillator in the receiver so that that carrier gets turned into a tone. Now you hear Morse code as a form of tones going on and off. You hear the dots and dashes, and you write it down, and it's a beautiful communication system. Let me drop. In the very early days of ham radio, Morse code was it, particularly when we finally got to the days of crystal controlled rings and not spark transmitters that were broadband as all heck. Alrighty. Eventually, somebody came up with the idea of connecting a microphone. In the beginning, it was nothing more than a carbon microphone acting as a variable load resistor on a tank coil. But at least amplitude modulation, in other words, you were able to make the carrier signal going to the antenna go up and down in amplitude with your voice by directly connecting a carbon microphone, which put a lot of heat dissipation in the poor carbon microphone. But it was the beginning. You know, later on, of course, that was all done electronically. That's amplitude modulation. And along came a guy named Armstrong who said that, gee, we don't have to make the amplitude go up and down. We can make the frequency go up and down with the audio. The positive voltage coming out of the microphone from my voice makes the carrier go slightly higher in frequency, and the negative voltage coming out of my voice and the microphone makes the frequency go a little bit lower, sweeping the frequency up and down. When Armstrong first proposed that, everybody said, hey, you're crazy. It can't possibly work. Let me drop it. Well, to make a long story short, not only did he make it work, but when you go to Alpine, New Jersey, you see that great big high, 350-foot high tower with the arms hanging off the side. That was done by Mr. Armstrong. That was his early FM transmitter. He went on FM broadcast at something like 46 megacycles, somewhere around World War II, and proved it, that it gave you high-fidelity audio and worked like a charm. Okay. The good news is now you can make the frequency going up and down. How much? I mean, in the case of amplitude modulation, when the audio makes the signal go to twice voltage and zero voltage on positive and negative peaks coming out of the microphone, we call that 100% modulation. And you don't want to go beyond 100% modulation, where you go up 110% and you try to go down 110%, which really means that when you're going down, you're creating time domain holes. And your transmitter starts sounding nonlinear and starts splattering. So in amplitude modulation, you don't want to go beyond 100%. With frequency modulation, now you've got a very different problem of definition. Let me drop. I can set up a receiver like the one you're listening to right now, which is specifically designed for a signal that goes plus and minus 5 kilohertz of FM deviation. In other words, the positive peaks out of my voice are making this transmitter go 5 kilohertz higher. The negative peaks out of my voice and microphone make the signal go 5 kilohertz lower. I may be rounding off the numbers, but you know what I mean. And you can specifically design a receiver for tuning that amount of FM deviation. By comparison, your FM broadcast at 88 to 108 megacycles, your commercial FM broadcast, uses plus or minus 75 kilohertz of deviation for a bunch of very good reasons, some of them traditional, some of them good engineering reasons. In the old days of analog television, the audio on the television set used to be plus or minus 25 kilohertz. So what's the right amount of deviation? 5 kilohertz the ham radio operators use, 25 kilohertz the television uses, 75 kilohertz that the FM broadcast uses, which is the best one? Depends on what you want to do. If you want the music to come out with very high fidelity and very low intermodulation distortion, you'll use the 75 kilohertz. If you're willing to tolerate some intermodulation distortion, then you're going to set the 5 kilohertz or the new FCC standards of something like 2.5 kilohertz, the so-called narrow band directive or mandate that was done in the last year or two. And all of a sudden, all commercial transmitters, let me drop. All commercial transmitters are supposed to go down to 2.5 kilohertz. And that's serving a huge disadvantage to us ham radio operators. You go out and buy a Baofeng or a Waxon radio today, and you get a tremendous amount of radio for the money. For about $25, $35, $40, you get a radio that goes from I think it's 50 megacycles to 450 megacycles inclusive, with all kinds of fancy doodads. And you get that for $40, the equivalent radio built by
Motorola, in the year 2000 or the year 1990, would be a couple of $1,000, and now you can buy a very compact, high-performance radio for $40 that does the same thing.